Welcome back to the Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us here in the studio is Daisy Fair from Copper Moose Farm. And she's here to give us an update on the season so far and some of the new techniques they're trying this year. So thanks for joining us, Daisy.
Hey, thanks, guys. I have a question for you guys first, though.
Uh-oh.
What
the tables have turned.
What is an agricultural engineer? You introduced me as that at the beginning.
You know,
that sounds really scary and hard.
That's
Chris.
You're engineering
has taken to
the
sneaking
land.
Things into the introduction.
You put the word chief in front of it too. I just about had a nervous breakdown on the drive here.
CAO.
We joke around that I'm the CFO,
right,
chief farm officer.
Now,
being a farmer is cool. Being an agricultural engineer is scary. That sounds scary.
Less cool,
don't worry,
Chris,
you can do
less
it.
Cool.
You've been little do you know, you've been doing it for years, Daisy.
Oh, gosh.
So what's happening at Copper Moose?
What's happening? Well, the most exciting thing is that the farm stand opens today.
Oh.
Big news.
I know. That's very exciting. So, yeah, we started the CSA last week. Farm stand opens today in 2.5 hours. Is that right? Yeah, something like that.
I'm amazed that you could make time to be here. Thank you.
Here I am. I have great staff. So.
So tell us about what's in the farm stand and the hours and availability.
So the farm stand will be open Tuesdays and Thursdays from 12 to 6 for the rest of the summer and Saturdays 9 to 3. For the rest of the summer.
Fantastic.
And, you know, just seasonal produce is in there right now. So we've got a lot of great greens and some of those early spring root crops like ping pong root. And,
ping pong root.
Well, you know, that's our new name for turnips because people are afraid of turnips. But our turnips, Nell, you know,
it's
I mean,
true.
You can eat them like a peach just right there.
You
just
can.
Eat it. They're amazing.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Mild and in a good
buttery
way.
Buttery and juicy. Yeah. And anyway, so radishes. And we've got a lot of our seedlings for sale there also right now for your home gardens. We're carrying some great stuff now. We've partnered with some great other local farmers and food producers. So Red Bicycle Bread, Auntie M's Baked Goods, Wasatch Creamery Ice Cream, Beehive Cheese, Ritual Chocolate, Pink Elephant Coffee, Uinta Coffee, grass-fed meats from Old Home Place and Taylor Made Beef. And now we're also carrying Old Home Place's eggs as well. So,
Ooh.
Oh, kombucha on tap. You know, good stuff.
There's so many goodies in that farm stand.
So many goodies.
Yeah. You know, you go to pick up your CSA and it's hard to get out of there without
a few
other things.
Yeah. So, but this spring we've been working on some fun. Well, it's not new. We're working on perfecting a couple techniques mm-hmm. that are helping us deal with our persistent weed problems.
That's something that I'm sure a lot of people in this town can relate to, especially anyone who gardens.
Yeah.
There are some weeds that will, you know, it seems never go away.
I
can relate to that, too, from the nature preserve perspective.
And I know you and I deal with a lot of the same stuff, being in the mm-hmm. same area of the basin. But for us right now, bindweed is one of our big problems. Bindweed.
Bindweed.
So for people mm-hmm. that might not be familiar with bindweed, it kind of looks like a morning glory. It grows along the ground, and it looks like a small little delicate morning glory.
Beautiful flowers that open in the morning. And
what color flowers? Because I think I have them.
Off-white, kind of a little pinkish.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have little blue flowers on some weed, what looks like weeds around my place. They're very
we'll
nice looking.
We'll get to those looking.
Next. Okay.
Weeds, you know, weeds are often beautiful because they were often brought here to be a decorative plant or a landscaping plant. And that's why so many of them have these great flowers.
So bindweed.
So bindweed is a problem for us because of its really, really fabulously engineered root system. So you pull bindweed out and it just regrows right back. If you till it up with your tractor, if you mm-hmm. have one, or your tiller, then you just spread it all over the place and it's going to grow again. So, and because of its really extensive root system, we use a practice called occultation, which is covering ground with plastic, black plastic preferably, and you smother the weeds so they don't have any sunlight to grow. Now, something like bindweed, you can cover it for, a month or so, and you pull the plastic off, and it looks like you've just made its life pretty tough, but it just starts regrowing right away. It greens right up and just goes for it. So we do use a mix of occultation, which does help deal with a lot of the annual weeds. So like ragweed or pig root, whatever you might want to call it, white top, hoary crest, all those guys that germinate really quickly and they are an annual. The occultation is fabulous for dealing with those weeds. And so that is something that home gardeners can do, because if you just have a little home garden bed, you can just get regular old black plastic, cover up your garden bed for 2 weeks, 3 weeks maybe, before you're ready to plant into it. And all those weed seeds that are in the top 2 inches of the soil, hopefully, will germinate and then not have any light source, and they will smother and die. It's also important to give the soil a good water before you cover it. So you've just created perfect conditions for all those weed seeds to germinate.
So the idea is to kind of break down that seed bank, get rid of all those
in
seeds
the top
sitting
2 inches
and
of
waiting
the soil.
In the soil.
So that's the important part also, is that once you uncover your bed from the plastic, you don't want to then dig it up a bunch, because then you're bringing up a bunch of new weed seeds from lower than the top 2 inches. So you do all your bed prep, you give it a nice water, and you cover it up with plastic and leave it alone for 2 to 3 weeks, depending on how warm it is.
And then you take the plastic off
and plant right
in.
Plant.
You don't have to do anything else to the soil.
No, nope, and hopefully you don't. If you have right. annual weeds. Now, if you have some of these persistent weeds like bindweed or thistle, which I know Nell deals with a lot also at the preserve, those guys are still going to be there, and you're going to need to hand pull those. But hopefully you're not going to disturb the soil too much right at the top, because the whole goal is that you've cleaned out that top 2 inches of soil. And anything below the top 2 inches of soil most likely is not going to germinate until you bring it up into the top 2 inches of soil.
Wow. Okay.
So these are annuals, though. These are not the perennial weeds.
But the bindweed, is that's a recent development?
No, I mean, bindweed's been around forever. Utah field bindweed is.
But you're just seeing more of it.
Yeah, we expanded 5 years ago into a new section of field that had bindweed.
Oh.
We didn't previously have bindweed as a problem. And before I had realized it was a problem, I'd done some tilling all over the farm and spread it around. So now I'm dealing with that. So there we are. But okay, so occultation is one way that we help to weaken the bindweed. So we do a lot of hand pulling of the bindweed.
Right.
We do a lot of flame weeding, which again is great for very small annual weeds. It knocks the bindweed back, but it just grows right back. But
is that what is it literally what it sounds like?
Flame weeding, yeah, We have a propane tank that goes on our back, and then we have a single wand burner that we do small areas with, and we have a big five burner with a hood over it that we walk over the beds, and you move pretty quickly because you're just trying to nip those small little newly germinated weeds, and it just burns them right up, and that's that. And you don't linger. You don't want to nuke the soil necessarily.
Right.
You're just trying to burn those little weeds. So it's great.
And all this is in place of, obviously, traditional spray.
Chemicals, yep,
you
exactly.
You do not want to do that. That's not part of your core value.
Not at all. We have no intention of ever putting toxic, persistent chemicals into our environment. And there are a lot of techniques that we use that make it so that perhaps I will grow and sell less salad or carrots or whatever it is this season. But it's making it, I hope, so that my child and my child's child and, you know, all of us are going to be healthier. That's our commitment.
I wanted to mention kind of organic practices, because that's, you know, you're an organic farm, but I believe that you guys dropped the official certification, right?
We did drop the official certification quite a while ago.
Yeah.
Because it didn't represent us, you know, the organic certification means a couple things if you don't look further into it. So if I go to the grocery store and I'm going to buy bananas, I will buy organic bananas over conventional bananas, because what I know is that persistent toxic chemicals, most likely, as long as everyone was being honest, were not sprayed on those crops. That's about all I can feel certain about. Other than that, there's so many differences in organic practices. And I practice more along the lines of what organics originally was. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a wide diversity of crops. We do a lot of crop rotation. We do a lot of cover crops. We're not just trying to pull all the nutrients out of the soil and leave it as dead in the next couple of years. You know, we are in this for the long, long, long haul. So we do a lot of things that cost more money and take way more time, which in any business, time is money. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't belong in the box with farms that are doing the least sort of possible this, like, to get their certification.
Large scale corporate, is that the right word for it?
Corporate, whatever, but organic, more it's the practices, And also we have the privilege to be able to talk to everyone who gets our produce.
Sure.
Whether they are folks just coming to the farm stand to purchase or whether they are our CSA members, we can talk to them. So not everybody has the opportunity to talk directly to their market. So that's one of the reasons we were able to drop it. And also we don't supply large scale wholesalers like Whole Foods or the grocery stores where it may be required that we have it. We don't do that, so we don't need it.
Right.
A lot of the paperwork and the record keeping that's required for the organic certification are great records to have anyway. So stuff that I had to start keeping track of for that certification process, I still keep track of because it's good information to have.
So I didn't mean to get us too sidetracked there, but I kind of wanted to just bring that up and mention it. But let's get back to some of the other techniques that you use in order to kind of in order to stay organic.
So one of the things that I'm really excited about, and we started it last year, but as with any organic practice, it takes a couple years at least, is again back to the bindweed. Sorry to harp on that, but it's such a devastating weed that to have anything else out there helping you while you're busy either pulling bindweed somewhere else or harvesting carrots or whatever, it just makes your heart feel better. And so I tracked down a program in Colorado. It's a state-funded program, and they are at the Palisades Insectary. They are breeding and distributing the bindweed gall mites and a moth that also eats the bindweed. So it's a long process. The gall mite will start affecting the leaves of the plant, hopefully, sickening it. In the winter, it then moves down into the roots of the plant, sickening the root. And after 3 to 4 or 5 years, you're going to start noticing a difference, which is great. I applied those last year in a test plot, and I've applied them again this spring in some new test plots. And then they didn't have enough of the moth larvae to send me last year, but I'm very excited that I got some moth larvae this year. And that's a very satisfying application process because you can see them and you put them directly on the bindweed. Whereas the mites, you know, you get some infested bindweed that you tangle up with your own bindweed, but you can't really see the bugs. So it's great putting out a larvae. So we've got this moth larvae that just defoliates the plant, very similar to what they're doing with the tamarisk, with that beetle
Tamarisk beetle, that's right.
We just talked about that on the air a couple of weeks ago.
So it will defoliate the plant, and if the plant is defoliated, it doesn't have enough nutrients to flower, which means it can't produce seeds. So that's part of our program that we're implementing. It's fun to watch, and I hope that it goes well, and I hope I get a great infestation of the gall mite, and then I can share them.
Like the tamarisk beetle, it's important that this larvae, this moth, focuses just on bindweed. It doesn't develop an appetite for other things.
So this program has been in practice in Colorado for 20 years.
Okay.
So 2 decades.
So there's a lot of research behind it.
I talked to them extensively. And of course, before the Colorado program made it statewide, they did a lot of studies on it. And then they found that it was effective and that they stuck to the bindweed. And so now it is a Colorado state-funded program where it's quite available to all the folks in the state. And they're happy to share. I do have to go down and pick it up and arrange to pick it up, which is a bit of a juggle. But it's well worth it, just like I said, to make my heart feel better to know that right now, while I'm on the radio, there's other things helping to take care of the bindweed.
And it goes with that long-term vision. I think, it's not going to work. It's not going to be your silver bullet this year or next, but when you look into the future, it's good to know that there's something else pushing this in the right direction, not just you guys desperately trying to pull it week after week.
Yep. And I know that you put out a rust last fall on thistles, and I'm excited to hear that one because thistle is our other persistent weed that we have a problem with.
So the Canada thistle is one that probably most people are familiar with. It's a small thistle. It's not the big musk thistle with the bright pink flowers. It's 5 feet high. This thing is growing a couple feet high at the most.
Purple
and tiny purple flowers. It's a perennial, so it's really tough to get rid of. And like the bindweed, it has, 10 times the root mass underground than it does above a ground. And it's something that, you know, was in place, you know, from many, many years of various disruption. And so now we're trying to figure out how to deal with it in ways other than using herbicides. It's not effective to pull the Canada thistle on any kind of large scale. So we again, worked with the Colorado Insectary. They're doing amazing work over there with the biocontrols to bring in a rust. And it's a rust fungus that impacts the plant and, again, overwinters in the roots. And we're waiting to see the results. We went out to try to do some monitoring a couple weeks ago, but it was still a little early to be able to tell if it had taken. So cross those fingers. We do have a variety of partners like Copper Moose that are excited about using it once we can sort of reproduce it and then help disperse it around town. So,
if you just joined us, we're speaking with Daisy Fair, Chief Farm Officer at Copper Moose Farms, etc. Just a farmer.
Just a farmer.
At Copper Moose Farms. And we're talking about, well, some of the challenges you're facing. Every year you have different challenges with respect to weeds. Anything new in the area of bugs?
No,
insects?
Not yet.
Just the usual.
Let's keep our fingers crossed on that one. I mean, with the weather changing the way it is, what a mild winter we had, which actually benefited us with one of our pests, which is the vole. Because we didn't, and I heard Nell talking about this again, or social media something, this winter with the preserve, but the voles didn't have a lot of snowpack to hide under and breed under this winter. And so I was expecting this is when we would typically start to build populations and I would start to lose more crops to the vole. So my winter planning, my spring sowings of turnips and radishes and carrots and beets, I increased because I plan on sharing along with the voles in this portion of the cycle. But with the low snow cover and the snow melting out quite a few times on the farm this winter, and our resident hawk population and, you know, coyotes and or foxes, our vole pressures right now, I'm afraid to even say it out loud, but are quite low. So that was great. There may be other problems that are going to pop up with the way the weather is changing. But
I did want to ask, you know, how has the kind of cloudy, stormy, rainy weather been impacting?
Oh, it's great. You know, since it's not snowing and freezing hard, this is fabulous. Vegetables love this. Makes it a little tricky sometimes for us to get into the field. You don't want to work the soil when it's too wet. That'll create soil damage that you'll deal with for the entire summer. But other than that, it's been great. I kid me, greens love this. And the greenhouses are, when the sun comes out, they warm up quite a bit. And so they store that heat, and the greenhouses have been great. So everything's going well. We did earlier this spring, you know, in a good cloudy spell, we lost quite a few cucumbers to damping off, which is a disease that'll happen in the soil when it's cool and moist for too long.
So damping
probably not
off.
Something that happens here a ton, huh?
No, not something that happens here a ton. Greenhouses are more prone to it, but I've never. This was exceptional this spring, what we had happen. You know, it's okay. Everything's fine. That's why we run a diversified farm, right? So say we lost half of our cucumbers. A, we'll replant them. And B, I have a, you know, tangle of other crops that are doing just fine out there. So that's one of the reasons to run a diversified farm and or garden, is that you're always going to have crop failures or things go slightly wrong or slightly better. And when you have such a wide variety of crops, you know, it's a bummer, but life goes on.
Yeah, you have to roll with it. Otherwise, I can imagine it would just be...
No matter what, you got to roll with it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So Chris mentioned pests, any new pests, but I know there are some that you deal with on, you know, an annual basis, and you've also tried to manage those with other insects,
so we do. We bring in a lot of bugs to our farm.
Love those bugs.
Yeah, love those bugs, because there they are working while I'm doing other things. Still working, but. So outsides, our biggest pest is the flea beetle, and by biggest, I mean largest quantity, because they're teeny, teeny, tiny. But they like all the spicy greens. So if anyone out there is noticing little tiny holes in their arugula, radish greens, young broccoli and kale greens, you know, a spicy mix for your salad, that's the flea beetle. And the lovely thing about the flea beetle, all you have to do is hide the crop from them if they're not in the crop. Once they're in the crop, That's it. But there's lightweight row covers that you can get, mostly online, I imagine, that you just cover the crop up right when it germinates and it hides it from the flea beetle. So that's easy peasy. It's a little, you know, it does increase our cost again, since we're not spraying chemicals, which are also quite expensive, I imagine. Mm-hmm. But we have this lightweight row cover. If you walk by the farm right now, it looks like we're growing white fabric and black plastic because we've got a lot of stuff covered right now. But that's hiding it from the flea beetles. Now, inside... in our greenhouses, our main problems are thrips, which are another teeny tiny insect, and aphids sometimes, especially with cool, cloudy weather. We start to get little aphid cropping up. But twice a month, I have a delivery of bugs, again, coming from Colorado. Those guys down there, they've got it going on.
They are ahead of the curve.
So I bring in, you know, a couple different little bugs to deal with the thrips. There's a mite that deals with them. There's a nematode that gets watered into the soil that deals with the larval stage. I bring in a predatory wasp to deal with the aphids. And again, that one's very gratifying because you can see it. And so they, you know, you introduce them to the area and they stick around. Now, ladybugs will fly out the window the minute the window is open. These predatory wasps, they inhabit the area that you put
they
them
move
out
on in.
As long as there is enough food for them, so aphids. And they're great because you can see them. They come my office is right in the back of the greenhouse and they'll come visit.
That's an interesting point. Two questions on that. You say, I bring in predatory wasps. That's not just one or two. How many are you talking?
So,
you know, what's the critical mass?
Right. So they do it all based on square footage of area that you're trying to treat. So I call up my folks down at Hydro Gardens in Colorado Springs, and I just have a standing order with them now. But yeah, they are great folks. You can talk to them on the phone, Hydro Gardens, and tell them you've got X amount of area, square footage that you're trying to treat, and they'll help you figure out how much you need.
So, and one of the wasps in general have some benefit. There are benefits to wasps and even as slight pollinators, but they also, they're protein consumers, right? Wasps, yellow jackets and stuff.
Well,
so talk about that, because if I see yellow jackets most commonly around my flowers and plants, it seems like they're patrolling the area.
Well,
they're
these guys,
food.
Want to clarify, these are teeny tiny wasps. You can see them.
Right.
But there's no way that if you like put your shoe on and it was in there that it would sting you or anything. So I want to clarify
right.
on that. It's not.
But do yellow jackets, should all yellow jackets be killed?
I don't think so.
What's your thoughts on
Nell?
That?
I'll turn that over now. I mean, I don't think
Any native insect species has a specific, distinct role in the ecosystem.
Okay.
So it's important to keep them around. Let them do what they do. Yeah.
Right. Within
now, if
reason.
Right by your front door.
If they're, you know,
problem,
building, you know, a nest in your electrical boxes, you know, may or may not have happened to me.
Right.
That may not be the place for them. But
otherwise, you know, seeing them periodically is not a bad thing for my for my plants. And like you say, they're part of the ecosystem. Okay. All right. We got like 3 or 4 more minutes. What else is
so much to say? So little time. How do we even decide?
Hey, I have. Oh, okay.
All right, Chris, you
one
first,
more.
Then Daisy.
You know, the big story for the last month or two was this E. coli event with romaine and such. What's your take generally on A, how that might have happened, and B, why it won't happen in Copper Moose?
Well, usually those things come from a potential source upstream of their water source.
Right, so contaminated feedlots. Water. Feedlots.
I mean, it's funny. It's a big box when you open that up, right? Is it it can point a finger to other problems in our food, our current food system,
right?
Like how many thousands of cows on a very small
and how many farm. How many hands, quote
and
unquote,
how many hands?
Handle it from field to supermarket shelf.
Yeah, exactly. And then also tracking it down, right? Because they narrowed it down to Yuma, Arizona, right? Mm-hmm. That's where they were able to narrow it down to. And because there are so many large producers, which I'm not saying is a bad thing, but it goes into a wholesaling warehouse and then is disseminated from there, it can take them a while to track it down to a single source. And I feel very bad for a lot of farmers out there who were growing romaine who lost a lot of business because of that.
Right.
You know, because it was probably just one source and it potentially was even, I'm not sure, but, you know, one or two batches that went out and then the problem was addressed.
Right.
Meanwhile, the entire romaine industry tanked for a little bit, and I feel really bad for those people. So, I mean, I know why it won't happen at Copper Moose is because I know where my water's coming from and I test it. and as they do also, I'm sure. But, you know, everyone who deals with the vegetables at Copper Moose, especially the washing and processing side, has their food handler's permit. You know, our space is inspected by the state. But I know all of that is going on at those farms, too. I really would hate to point fingers at the actual farmers. I feel like it's probably something that's happening upstream that, you know, farmers need to use their water, and water testing is very expensive. And so, you know, we get our water from a well. So that's great because it means the water has already percolated down through the crust and been cleaned quite a bit. And then we do test it regularly. But yeah.
Okay. No, it's
such a shame. Yeah, it's a real hard one. I also think, can't help but lean towards the fact that we are attempting to become such a sterile society that our guts on their own are not able to deal with some of these invaders, that a person who's been exposed to a lot of different things, their guts might be able to deal with it. Hmm. And I'm not specifically
diversity.
Talking about E. coli,
it
but I'm
goes
talking
back
about,
to diversity,
yeah,
even within our gut biome.
That's exactly it.
Okay. Now,
we checked it off.
You got that?
Garlic mustard.
Garlic, we got to make 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Here
2 minutes
for
garlic mustard. Because that's another persistent weed that's everywhere. You know, I've got it approaching my house up in the Timberline area. We have it on the farm. And boy, that one.
It's working its way down through Snyderville Basin. Sort
you see,
of
you're seeing
up
the.
Up here in the Park City, and it's working its way down the streams. It is, yeah.
Same thing from Summit Park down, you know, coming into the basin from that direction. And that one's a tricky one, eh, Nell? I mean, if you're going to pull it, you have to pull it regularly for 3 years. But I believe that's the case for spraying, too, right? If you're going to spray it, it's a 3-year process. So. Yeah. You know, my perspective is my son and I, we go out on the weekends and or after work sometimes. We'll go pick a trail section, go hiking, pull a bunch of garlic mustard, bag it up. Man, you can pull out so much garlic mustard in such
a
small amount of time.
Easy to pull.
Easy to pull. It doesn't sting. It doesn't scratch. It doesn't have burrs.
That's
and
so true.
And you can eat it. You can actually make,
that's
edible.
That's what I was going to ask.
You can make garlic,
you can
garlic
make a
mustard pesto.
Yeah. I've heard of people sauteing it.
Really?
Yeah.
Deep fry it?
There you go.
Why not?
Put it in
dipping
chocolate.
Sauce.
So we may be able to eat it, but I realize the deer, a lot of the wildlife, do not eat it. Is that correct now?
But, you know, I don't know. Most likely those non-native species, the native wildlife, don't know that they can eat it. They're not familiar with it as a food source. And so they, you know, the garlic mustard probably right now doesn't have any natural native predators that are going to eat it or insects that will invade it or any of those things.
And one of the reasons it's such a problem is because of what it does to the soil, which Nell should expand on.
You got one
so
minute.
It's an allelopathic plant, so it's going
to
put things in the soil that that prevent other plants from growing. So you'll
like
see
salt
really
cedar
dense,
does or tamarisk does, right?
So then reducing
Google
diversity.
Garlic mustard, so you know what it looks like. Small white flower, heart-shaped green leaves. Maybe
smells
a couple
like garlic.
Feet tall. Yeah.
Get out there and pick it.
Yeah,
enjoy.
Do it. Let's pull it out.
You should have a class on all this, Daisy. Yeah.
I think the community
maybe
gardens
we should, do that together
should take up that challenge.
With community gardens and eats.
And
we'll tackle those
noxious
weeds. Let's
see. Open space, people. Let's
all right.
do it.
No.
All right, so we'll see you all at the farm stand today at noon or 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6. And same thing on Thursday and then Saturday too.
Saturday, what are the hours Saturday again?
9 to 3
9
on
to 3.
Saturdays. Yep. Okay. So 1285 Old Ranch Road is where the farm stand is.
Look for
we'll
all the
there.
White and black plastic.
We can't. Oh gosh, you actually can't see it from the farm stand.
Okay.
That sounded terrible.
I know. But for good reason.
Thanks, guys. Have
Daisy
thanks,
Fair,
Daisy.
Copper Moose Farms. Thanks so much as usual. And quick break. We'll be right back to wrap up. It's this screen.